is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Wow, I have such a large stack of stuff here I want to go through with you today. You know, as opposed to like one giant topic for the day, there's stuff happening all over the place, from the Middle East to the to the halls of Congress, to whatever, to Baltimore. In fact, speaking of Baltimore, remember last week I was saying, where are the good cops? The president, basically said, most cops are just great people. There's a few bad apples. Well, if there's a few bad apples, then why is it that, presumably there's one or two in probably most large police departments, maybe only one or two, then why is it that the good cops aren't calling them out? Where are the good cops? Well, here's one. This guy, Joseph Crystal of the Baltimore Police Department. He says that he was targeted by other officers for trying to root out corruption. One officer told him, if you snitch, your career is done. This article at countercurrentnews.com. He eventually became public enemy number one inside the Baltimore Police Department, but before that he was considered a rising star in law enforcement. He's the son of two New York police cops in charge of his police academy class, cadet class in the start. Only 2 years on the force, promoted to detective. Being a cop was all I ever wanted to do. He says it was a dream come true. But all that changed after he came forward to report the 2011 beating of a drug suspect by another officer. His testimony helped to secure convictions against the officer who beat the suspect and the sergeant who'd helped. But Crystal says that was part of a systemic pattern of abuse. He's now suing the Baltimore Police Department for failing to protect him from the other cops in his department. Yikes. Okay, there's that. And Michelle Obama's comments over the weekend about how shocked she was by the essentially wave of racism that hit her when she became first lady. The headline over at The Guardian just says the whole thing. Michelle Obama, I was knocked back by race perceptions. We have so far to go in this country. We have so far to go. Meanwhile, the job creators, right? The big corporations, Apple, Microsoft, Google, Pfizer, Cisco, the billionaires, the job creators. Why are they not creating jobs? Well, this might have something to do with it. This is from the Financial Times. The headline, top 50 U.S. boardroom hoarders sit on $1 trillion in cash. Just five U.S. companies are hoarding nearly $500 billion. Apple, Microsoft, Google, Pfizer, and Cisco are sitting on $439 billion in cash, accounting for more than a quarter of the total of $1.7 trillion being held by U.S. companies. This is according to Moody's Investor Service, according to the Financial Times. The top 50 hold $1.1 trillion. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means they're not building factories with it. It means they're not marketing new products with it. It means they're not doing research and development with it. It means that they're not doing any of those things that the shills for Reaganism told us back in the 80s. If we just cut the taxes on the big corporations, if we just, let them put their money wherever they want, keep it in China, keep it in Europe, whatever you want. If we just let them play on an international stage in, with absolutely no Americanism involved, no domestic content agreements, no tariffs, no nothing. We just let them do this. Laissez-faire. Let them write the rules. Let them run the show. Let them write the trade agreements. If we just do that, these corporations will create all kinds of jobs for America. No. They're hoarding almost $2 trillion in cash. I had an insight over the weekend, and maybe I'm reading too much into this. But as you know, I'm really confounded. I mean, genuinely confounded by President Obama's support for SHAFTA, the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, also known as the TPP. And I'm deeply concerned about his support for Fast Track, the TPA, they call it, Trade Protection Authority or Trade Promotion Authority, excuse me, that, you know, he's a constitutional scholar. You would think that he would realize that the Constitution says treaties require two-thirds vote of the Senate. This is a treaty. I don't see how you can call it anything other than that. It involves 11 other nations. And yet he wants to abrogate the powers of Congress. And virtually every Republican in the House and Senate is saying, yeah, we're with you, brother. Let's do it. By brother, I didn't mean that in any just a figure of speech. But in any case, why, right? The question that has been in my mind for these many months is, why would he do that? Why is it that a couple of years ago he tried to strike a grand bargain with John Boehner and said he was willing to put cutting Social Security on the table in the form of the chain CPI? Why? Well, here's what he had to say about Elizabeth Warren. He says, the truth of the matter is Elizabeth is, you know, a politician like everyone else. Now, hang on just a second here. Yes, you have to become a politician to be in politics. But Elizabeth Warren is not running for re-election in 2016. She's not running for anything. She's not on the ballot. And she's certainly not going to get big donations from the banks for saying the things that she's saying. But we judge others by ourselves. Right? Have you ever noticed that people who always think that people are trying to steal from them are the people that probably would steal if they had a chance? Have you ever noticed that the people who think that everybody must be doing, I mean, fill in the blank, right? Oh, people are all cynical. Cynics say that. So could it be that what he's really doing here is revealing his inner self, that he thinks of himself, and maybe as a consequence of 6 years in the White House, maybe this has been his career, I don't know, but he thinks of himself as a politician rather than as, you know, an agent of change. He didn't come into the White House thinking of himself as FDR or LBJ. He came into the White House thinking of himself as, I guess, Bill Clinton, the consummate politician. He goes on to say, and, you know, she's got a voice that she wants to get out there, and I understand that. Well, she actually, I don't think Elizabeth Warren is doing this for Elizabeth Warren. I might be wrong. It could be that she's got an ego bigger than this room. But I've met her. I've listened to her speak. I've talked very briefly with her, but I was at a private fundraiser for her, a couple of years ago, with only about 30 people in the room for maybe 45 minutes, thereabouts. I was very impressed. And what I got out of that was that it for her, much like for Bernie, it's not about the ego, it's about the issues. She didn't want to run for the Senate, remember? She got drafted. I mean, they just dragged her kicking and screaming into that race for the Senate. But President Obama, on the other hand, a meteoric rise. So is he saying I'm just a politician? I hope not. I genuinely hope not. Stories about Raul Castro. I've got a libertarian rant I'm going to pick up after the break. I mean, there's just so much going on. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with the newest libertarian scandal that the New York Times has been covering in just a few minutes. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Charles in Lakewood, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on Roku. How cool is that? Hey, Charles, what's up?
I love it. Doesn't cost me a cent, Tom.
I know. I have Louise and I have Roku at home. It's super.
I'm sure I'm not getting all the functionality out of it. I wanted to tell you about a circumstance that happened to me close to 30 years ago in an Eastern Washington, that is Washington State, Eastern Washington City, when I was in the police reserves. You're familiar with police reserves?
I'm not. Tell me about it.
Typically, it is a volunteer force that is drawn from when necessary or for minor functions, maybe traffic, or, you know, they're essentially volunteers. And I was a police reservist in, I probably won't say the city. I mean, it was 30 years ago and bigger problems and hopefully put it behind them. And I was training with the chief of police reserves. And we roll on a call about a poor drunk Hispanic guy in an alley, and I saw the police, the chief of police reserves. I'm sorry, I'm a little upset and a little nervous about it, Tom.
Okay.
But I did see him bounce this poor old drunk Mexican off the trunk of his car. Eventually, took him into custody, and about a week later, I asked the staff of police reserves about it, and they said, "Gee, no, we don't have any problems, you know, with minorities here." And about a week later, they said, "You know, maybe we're not right for you." And I thought, you know, maybe you're not. And back then, you know, the migrant farm workers would be coming into town and doing us whole bunches of good. But nowadays, there's real racial strife in this city, and you know, I don't think that it was had anything to do with the minorities themselves.
Yeah,
it's just a sad scene.
Yeah, it is. So basically, you were peripheral but part of a police department. You sort of blew the whistle and you got bounced out.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, amazing story.
But that's okay. I you know, joined the military not too long after that, and hopefully made a difference on a larger scale.
Yeah, there you go. Charles, thanks for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Tom. Talk to you later.
Appreciate the call. Thanks. Steve in Owenton, Kentucky. Hey, Steve, quick one, and we got a minute.
Yeah, a pretty quick one. Yeah, I watched your opening statements about, you know, the pay gap in male and female workers, but I don't know in what careers that would be, because most of my working life, they've always made the same as I made, you know. It kind of depended on the job you were in, and you started. You had, of course, you have a starting salary, but then you work your way up. You know, within so many months or days or weeks that then you're at the level with everyone else. But I'm sure I keep hearing this, but I've never had that experience in my life where a lady was paid less than I was.
Steve, I'd suggest you talk to some of the women, you know.
Yeah, but I don't know what career.
It's sort of like, you know, white people saying, "I've never experienced racial discrimination."
You
know, you and I are two guys sitting here.
But I worked for Bendix Corporation, and there were different job titles and different things, and you know, the pay scales were all posted and everything.
Yeah, well, that's a rare corporation. I mean, that's the same thing in the government. You know what somebody's pay grade is, and so it doesn't happen so much. In fact, there's only about 11% difference among government jobs. But it's much larger in those companies that do not disclose the pay of their workers. Steve, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, let me just start working my way through my stack here, and then I'll pick up some of your phone calls on some of these issues. It's the King of Saudi Arabia today. Is saying that he's not going there. The White House, the Obama administration is holding a conference at the White House on what's going on in the Middle East, which seems to me like a really important thing. And apparently the new king, King Salman, I'm not sure exactly how to say it, is not pleased with the fact that the White House is reaching out to Iran. They view Iran as a regional enemy the same way Israel does. And here we're making nice with them in order to prevent them from getting a nuclear bomb, which seems like that would be the kind of thing that regional enemies would appreciate. You know, we're going to keep them from getting a bomb, but apparently not. I just don't get it. Victoria Jones writing in the Talk Radio News' daily news summary. In a bit of a surprise, Saudi Arabia announced Sunday that its new monarch, King Salman, wouldn't be attending meetings at the White House with President Obama or a summit at Camp David this week, in an apparent signal that it continues to be ticked off over U.S. relations with Iran, its rising regional adversary. As recently as Friday, he had said he would be coming. The fact that he's not is now its top headline, or one of the top headlines over in the Financial Times today, too. Apparently, the deputy crown prince and the defense minister will attend. So it's not a total boycott, but it's a dissing, right? Your president's going to be there. Our king's not. I continue to be of the opinion, just personally, that our developing a more multipolar foreign policy that includes relationships with groups that we have historically not talked with, Iran, Cuba, for example, and developing a stronger relationship with Russia, and maybe backing off a little bit on the relationships that we have with some of the countries that are just basically exploiting us economically, like China, would be a healthy thing. But then I'm not the head of the State Department, so. And Raul Castro. You know, Karl Marx wrote that religion is the opiate of the masses, and as a consequence of that, communist governments have historically been atheist governments. And in the early years of the Castro regime, they pretty much cracked down on anybody who wanted to go to church. They closed the churches, they hassled people who were, very religious. So Raul Castro, on his way back from the VE Day ceremony in Moscow on Friday or Saturday, stops at the Vatican and hangs out with Pope Francis. And he says he was so impressed by Pope Francis, who's talking about the poor, right? Talking about the actual ministry of Jesus. And he says, I will resume praying and turn to the church again if the Pope continues in this vein. And he also thanked the Pope for brokering the rapprochement between the U.S. and Cuba, which I think most Americans have forgotten. You know, President Obama gets a lot of credit for this, correctly so. And he took the opportunity and ran with it. But it was apparently the Pope who set this opportunity up, which is really a cool thing. Okay. This is an article by Emily Queenan in The Record, which is an online newspaper. She writes, I'm a family physician who has decided to relocate to Canada. The hassles of working in the dysfunctional healthcare system in the U.S. have simply become too intense. I'm not alone. According to a physician recruiter in Windsor, over the past decade, more than 100 U.S. doctors have relocated to her city alone. Now, Windsor's the town that's opposite Detroit on the other side of the little river there, the Detroit River, that connects Lake Erie to Lake Huron, if my recollection is correct. And, it was just a kind of a bedroom community to Toronto. Actually, it's not even a bedroom community. It's about an hour drive away, but it's a small town. 100 U.S. doctors going just to that town? Just to Windsor? She says, like many of my U.S. counterparts, I'm moving to Canada because I'm tired of doing daily battle with the same adversary that my patients face, the private health insurance industry. This is an industry, a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry here in the United States that, by and large, does not exist in other countries. Or it exists in a very, very, very smaller, weaker, less politically potent, and less troublesome, and less predatory, and less parasitic form in the other OECD countries than it exists here in the United States. Because you don't need health insurance in every other developed country in the world, because they have national healthcare system. I mean, it's pretty straightforward stuff. She says 16% of doctors' working time is spent just dealing with paperwork from the health insurance companies. And then on top of that, one in every 14 claims is paid incorrectly. About 5% outright denials of payment. She says, I love working with my work and my patients, but after 5 years of constantly fighting with multiple private insurance companies, she had opened a practice in Rochester, New York. I made the heart-wrenching decision to close my practice down. The emotional stress was too great. My spirit was being crushed. It broke my heart to have to pressure my patients to pay their bills, the bills their insurance companies said they owed. Private insurance never covers the whole bill and won't kick in until the patients have covered the deductible. And, you know, just our system is so screwed up here. My libertarian rant after the break and your call. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Yes, people are dying in America. Babies are being miscarried. Birth defects. And the libertarians, this is the way they would like it. Just a couple of other amazing little factoids here. Pope Francis, today, Pope Francis, Raul Castro saluting the Pope. This is in Vatican City. Pope Francis said Monday, this is from ANSA, the Asian National, it's a news service, ready as, it's in, it, I don't know what the acronym stands for, but it's not English. But in any case, Pope Francis said Monday that many powerful people don't want peace because they live off war. That's a verbatim quote. The Argentine pontiff made the hard-hitting comment in response to a question from one of the 7,000 children taking part in an audience held with the Peace Factory organization. This is serious, Francis told the children. Some powerful people make their living with the production of arms. It's the industry of death. Turns out Freddie Gray wasn't the only guy who got the stuffing beat out of him someplace by somebody and then didn't get medical help. From June 2012 to April 2015, correction officers at Baltimore City Detention Center refused to admit nearly 2,600 detainees who were in police custody. Now let me explain this. 2,600 times cops brought badly beaten and arrested detainees to the jail, and the jail said that person is in such bad shape they need to go to the hospital. 2,600 times in a three-year period. You think there's not something wrong there? Okay, I promised you a rant on libertarians and then to your calls. This from the New York Times today. It was over the weekend. It was the New York Times Magazine. Nail salon workers in New York City face hazardous chemicals. I can't read the headline to you because when you print from the New York Times, I don't know if they know that this print function is all screwed up. But when you print from the New York Times, the headlines turn into gibberish, looks like in English, and the subheads turn into Japanese and Korean gibberish. So, hey, anybody at NewYorkTimes.com, wake up. In any case, it talks about Mrs. Otavalo. She's a Ecuadorian immigrant, 39 years old, who is nail stylist, right? I forget the word for the person who does nails. Manicurist, I guess. They talk about how she loves to talk about her 9-year-old boy, but she never spoke of another dreamed-for child, the one lost last year in a miscarriage that began while she was giving a customer a shoulder rub or shoulder massage. At the second table, they're just going down the row in this nail salon. At the second table was Monica Rocano, 30, who sometimes brought her daughter to visit, but clients had never met her 3-year-old son, Matthew. People thought Matthew was shy, but in fact, he has barely learned how to speak. He's 3 and can walk only with great difficulty. A chair down from Ms. Rocano was another quieter manicurist. In her idle moments, she surfed the internet on her phone seeking something that might explain the miscarriage that she had last year or the 4 other miscarriages that came before that. Now, again, quoting from the New York Times, and I'm sorry, I don't have the author's name on this either because it printed as gibberish. Some of the chemicals in nail products are known to cause cancer. Others have been linked to abnormal fetal development, miscarriages, and other harms to reproductive health. So you have to ask yourself the question, why is this stuff out there? Why is it that women are using things in the privacy of their own homes that can cause miscarriage and cancer? And why is it that workers who work with these chemicals for hours every day rather than just minutes are not protected? Back to the New York Times article. A number of studies have also found that cosmetologists, a group that includes manicurists, as well as hairdressers and makeup artists, have elevated rates of death from Hodgkin's disease, low birth weight babies, and of multiple myeloma, a form of cancer. And then they go on to note, the federal law that regulates cosmetic safeties, which is more than 75 years old, does not require companies to share safety information with the Food and Drug Administration. The law contains no provisions for the agency to evaluate the effects of the chemicals before they are put on the shelves. In other words, you and I are all the guinea pigs, which is exactly the way libertarians like it. Right? Libertarians say that the solution to things is not regulation, but litigation. That if somebody puts a harmful chemical out in the marketplace, and you're harmed by it, and you can demonstrate that, you should be able to sue, and those lawsuits will pile up to the point where the company will stop putting that kind of a product out because, hey, it's not profitable anymore because we get sued. Now, it sounds nice, but A, it assumes that everybody has the resources to sue, right? That everybody's some kind of upper-middle-class person or upper-class person economically who has the money to go down to their favorite local lawyer and say, you know, here's 20 grand, please take my case. And that's not true, number one. And number two, this is a crazy way to run for a country to take care of itself. Now, in Europe, they've got the precautionary principle. You have to, before you can introduce a chemical that might be absorbed by humans, whether it's breathed or on their nails or in their, you know, food or whatever, you have to demonstrate that it's safe. And then they allow it on the market. Here in the United States, you do not have to demonstrate safety. They take things off the market after a bunch of people have died. New York Times notes, industry lobbies have fought tougher monitoring requirements. Bill de Blasio just came out and said, okay, we're going to protect the manicurists in New York because that's where the story was done. But this is the stark difference. This is the hugely stark difference between the Reaganism libertarian theology of the so-called free marketplace and the reality of average people in the United States, and by the way, we can't use the word middle class apparently anymore. Another piece in the New York Times today about how none of the politicians, I'll get into that later on in the program, are using the phrase middle class because there isn't one anymore. Or at least people are nervous that they're not going to be in it. But anyway, off we go. So let's pick up some phone calls here. And I've got plenty of material here for the next 2 hours as well. I am... less than one-fifth of the way through my stack. Mike, in Portland, Oregon, listening on X-Ray FM. Hey, Mike, TPP?
Yeah, hey, Tom, long-time listener, first-time caller. Okay. I heard a funny idea about the TPP. I like the Shasta name, by the way. But another tactic to use might be renaming it Obama Trade, and that would be since more Republicans are apt to support it, if we can somehow turn it into like an Obamacare.
I agree, Mike.
Obama trade.
I agree. Calling it Obama trade is probably a good idea. It's probably not such a good idea in this venue, like on my show, because, you know, people know what we're talking about. I think we have a fairly sophisticated audience. But if it was to break through into the mainstream media, if CNN started referring to it as Obama trade, but that's not going to happen unless the White House does. And the White House definitely will not. So, you know, then it would be viewed as a slur. The thing that to reduce Republican support, the thing that most concerns me on this thing is that there's no honest discussion of Obama trade or Shafter or TPP or whatever you want to call it. And there's no honest discussion about the TPA, about the fast track in our media. It's all sound bites and shills, basically. And the president pushing this just has me completely baffled. I don't get it. If the deal is so good, show it to us. If it's not so good, stop telling us, trust me. Right? If it's so good, Congress should be able to deal with it. Mike, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to X-Ray FM. Rich in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Tom, you have so many things you were talking about, but I want to talk about the first thing you were saying about corruption with the police departments.
Yes.
Across the country and about beatings. I'll tell you this, as a former cop in a big city back east, I know that as a cop, as a patrolman, that if somebody, quote-unquote, is a snitch or rat, what they do to them is if you're in a very dangerous situation, they won't back you up. So you could have a man with a gun or something, and you're at a location, you put it over the air, nobody shows up. That's how they get back at them. It's a very dangerous thing. And it's not just patrolmen. I just want to talk about something really quick about a guy named Michael Dowd in New York City who in Brooklyn was robbing drug dealers at gunpoint, taking the drugs and money and selling them out on Long Island. Every cop in the precinct knew this guy was dirty. The bosses knew that he was dirty. Internal affairs knew he was dirty. When it went up the chain of command, the New York City Police Department turned a blind eye to him. And they told every cop that worked with this guy, stay away from him, stay away from him. And eventually the feds came in and locked the guy up, and he did prison time. But it goes to show you that the corruption is not necessarily at the precinct level. It goes all the way up the ladder to the chiefs and everybody else. Everybody's involved in this, and
Rich,
it needs to stop.
Yeah, I agree. Rich, as a former New York City police officer, to what extent do you think this is the result of the essentially military hierarchical command and control structure of police departments, as opposed to a more collaborative or I hate to use the word business-like culture. We have about a half a minute here before the break.
Let me explain something to you, Tom, and this is something. I was a cop in the 80s and the 90s, okay?
Yeah.
And we did a lot of transactional analysis. A lot of this stuff, you go to a situation, you try to de-escalate it, okay?
Right.
I do not know, after 9/11, and this is one thing that frightens me as a former cop, is that after 9/11, this militarization of the police, the abandonment of the Fourth Amendment, the things that have gone on, really has changed the police department into more of a militaristic type of organization.
Right.
What they're teaching these police academies, Tom, I have no idea. But it seems to be very detrimental to the public at large, my friend.
Yeah. Okay. Rich, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for the insight from a former cop himself. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, we'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. You can drop into our free live chat room at TomHartman.com and say hi. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Don in Seattle. Hey, Don, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, Tom, I watched something on the local TV last night about some of the Walmart stores across the country that are shutting down, and apparently they're trying to turn them into FEMA camps with barbed wire and whatnot, ripping up the floors and everything.
Right.
And I saw a photo of like 1,200 armored personnel carriers in the desert southwest area. Have you followed any of that, what's going on with the Walmart stores? And I'd like to know what the Walton family itself is involved in all.
At any, you know, there's hundreds of Walmart stores all over the United States.
Yeah.
And one of my brothers actually is an electrician. And, well, actually, I'm not sure that Stan was working on for Walmart. I think he was working for Myers, which competes with Walmart in Michigan. But, you know, he used to wire these stores. And at any given moment, you're going to have a couple of stores around the country that are shut down for renovations. Now,
that's what they say, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if it's something that you've got to do. You've replaced the shelves, replace the – what Stan used to do is replace the wiring. You know, every time there was an upgrade in Internet systems and things so that the cash registers and the inventory control system and everything could all operate, you know, seamlessly, you had to go from Cat 3 wiring to Cat 4 wiring, then up to Cat 5 wiring. You know, you had to rewire everything because – you know, the data speeds were increasing and, you know, putting new computers in, new cash registers. So they basically shut down the store for a month and just redo it. And that's one story about why five Walmart stores in Texas are closed right now for renovation. And, you know, turning them into FEMA camps, that's crazy. The other story, though, that I've heard but have not been able to verify is that Walmart tends to pick stores to renovate where there are active attempts to unionize. But which of those is the case, I honestly don't have any idea, you know, or which of the two variables. But I can tell you that the White House and Walmart are not working together to create FEMA camps and round up people in Texas. This is just naked, hateful paranoia. And it's being spread by people who have an economic axe to grind. I mean, you know, the more people who go over to the websites of the online and radio conspiracy theorists, and you see all the ads on their websites for everything from guns to canned foods and things, and These guys, you know, it's like Mike Huckabee, you know, selling his anti-diabetes pills on his website. These guys are hustlers. They're hustlers who are trying to find gullible suckers and scare the hell out of them. And then they'll come back and say, hey, you know, send us $25 to help us publicize this. And by the way, visit our website and look at all of our sponsors and, you know, we'll make some money off that. This is a business, basically. So, you know, if you are concerned about the you know, what's happening with Operation Jade Helm and all this kind of stuff,
yeah,
I would suggest that you check out some of the little more rational sites. MediaMatters.org, for example, has done a great job of exposing how, you know, where these conspiracies are coming from and who's making a buck off them. Don, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. David in Sacramento. Hey, David. Jeb Bush?
Oh, yeah. That's awful. Did you hear about the interview?
Yeah, I didn't see the interview, but I've read three articles about it this morning that basically Jeb Bush said that he would have invaded Iraq, too. What people are forgetting and what the media never points out is that 4 years before George W. Bush invaded Iraq, his brother Jeb signed the letter from the Project for a New American Century to Bill Clinton in 1998, demanding that Bill Clinton invade Iraq. So it's not like, right, you know, Jeb just came around to this and said, hey, my brother did it. I think it's a great idea. He had been pushing for it 2 years before his brother was even president. And they're treating him like he's not a neocon, like he's not, you know, part of that Wolfowitz crowd that, you know, Wolfowitz also signed that letter.
He's still under the cloud of his brother anyway. So I mean, he's only got like 3%, or and Carly Fiore's got like 2% or whatever. But you know, they used to call it the clown car, but now they can't fit all those people in a car, so they call it the clown bus.
Yeah.
Because they can fit a lot of those clowns in a bus. But to make a long story short, you know, when you get him sitting there, remember Hillary had said that she was against this whole Iraq war in 2008.
Right.
Well, he sat there. He said that. Well, if she told him, I said, would you do it if you had to do it all over again? Would you do it? He says, yeah. And he said, also, Hillary would do it too. And says, How can you put those words in her mouth when she was against it in 2008?
Yeah, it's really a lie. But see, you got to understand, David. He's a Republican. The only way Republicans can win elections is to lie to people. Because the Republican agenda, very simply, is do whatever works for the billionaire class and the transnational corporations, period, full stop. And when it comes to average working people, you know, if you want to bring them along, you either have to lie to them or you got to find those small wedge issues where they're with you and they're not with the Democratic Party. And it's just, you know, so I'm not surprised that Jeb Bush lied in the interview about Hillary Clinton. I mean, that's a small lie compared to the huge lies that are being told about Hillary Clinton all over the place. But
right, but what the old saying goes, that once a liar is always a liar, just like Carly Fiore saying that she had basically got ousted from the HP. And then they also on CBS had said that she was basically the worst CEO of all time.
Right. And she laid off 30,000 workers. And bragged about it. Said she would have done it earlier when they asked her, you know, what did you think about that? Well, I should have done it earlier. Really?
You're so pathetic, huh?
I had a really interesting conversation last Friday with a guy that I'm not going to name, but trust me, he's a serious Washington D.C. political analyst. You would recognize his name immediately. Here in the Beltway, and his comment to me was that the Republican ticket, two things. Number one, most of the guys who are running for the Republican, this doesn't happen on the Democratic side. When people declare that they want to be a Democratic president, they put out the issues, right? And they say, here's what I'm... But on the Republican side, most of these candidates are hustlers. You know, they're doing it because it's a career path for them. They're not actually seriously trying to become president. They're trying to make money in most cases. But secondly, he told me the story of Brian Sandoval, which I did not know. Brian Sandoval was the, what, governor of Nevada, I think, or the senator from Nevada. He's a very prominent Nevada politician and a Republican. And he had an opportunity to run in the in either the governor's race or the Senate, I forget which, and he turned it down in the last couple of years. He turned it down. And nobody could figure out why until he actually, in an interview, said that he thinks that he should be available to be the vice presidential pick, because Nevada is a Western state. It's a state that he could carry. He's popular there. And this fellow told me that he thinks that the ticket, the Republican ticket, is going to be Scott Walker and Brian Sandoval, and that ticket will be very hard to beat, because Scott Walker will have $1 billion from the Koch brothers behind him, and Brian Sandoval can pull in most of the Western vote. That's kind of scary stuff. So Jeb Bush might not even be a factor here, David. We'll see. But anyhow, you heard it here first.
Tom, like I said, if anybody wants to know more about these Republican candidates, and they're just totally uninformed and uneducated, why don't they just type their first and last name on Wikipedia, and that will tell you the whole thing about their life and their biography. So that way it makes you think twice before you vote for these idiots.
Yeah, although the Wikipedia can be subject to some fairly aggressive editing by the candidates themselves. But, yeah, I'm with you. David, thanks for the call. Larry in Elgin, Illinois, you wanted to get back to Shafta?
Yeah, Tom, I appreciate all your passion and compassion you have for the work you do there. And just another perspective on it, not one that I necessarily support, but I think there's a bigger play here. Sure, we're being driven by the 0.5% of transcontinental corporations, but there's a strategic alignment that is trying to be, I think, formed between Japan and those countries in that area to counterbalance China.
Right, well, let them do it.
Over those seas.
Let them do it.
Well,
there's only, you know, in the TPP, there are only five sections of the TPP that deal with trade. The rest of them deal with things like intellectual property, the internet, security, the ability of corporations to sue governments. This is not a trade deal. This is a treaty, and it's rewriting the international laws of behavior. And, you know, if we want to deal with China, it's very, very simple. All we have to do is say that, you know, we will not deal with companies that manipulate their currency, or we will put, you know, tariffs in place to compensate for currency manipulation. Step one. I mean, you know, that in itself is going to knock down by 2 or 3, maybe 4 or 5%, you know, our trade deficit with China, which is huge. I mean, we had a $51 billion trade deficit last year. Every $1 billion is 10,000 U.S. jobs gone. So it's just, you know,
I think it's more to tie them up strategically in the
but it's not going to happen.
Government.
It's not going to happen, Larry. The way you do this is at the level of our government, our trade policies. Our trade policies need to be for the benefit of the United States, not for the benefit of 11 countries in Asia that want to compete with China. It should be for our benefit. Larry, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's coming up on the top of the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Stick around. Oh, and we're going to have a bit of a debate here, I think. Yeah? Okay. Neil McCabe is going to drop by. This should be interesting. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And if I can find my cursor here, Neil McCabe is on the line with us, conservative columnist with townhall.com, editor of the Washington Mercury News website, thewashingtonmercury.com. Neil, welcome back.
Hey, great to be with you, Tom. I didn't talk to you yesterday, so happy Mother's Day.
Well, thank you. Or I'll pass that along to Louise.
Very good.
And back at you to any mothers in your family.
Sure.
And in fact, let's both wish all of the mothers watching a belated Happy Mother's Day.
We couldn't do it without them, Tom.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here without them, Neil. what I wanted to talk with you today about is Bernie Sanders' platform. And I'll just go through and read the bullet points, you know, just the outline, as it were, and then we can discuss these one by one. Your perspective as a conservative Republican, mine as a progressive liberal Democrat, whatever.
Sure.
Number one, income and wealth inequality. Number two, jobs and income. Number three, campaign finance reform. Number four, climate change. Number five, college affordability. Number six, health care. Number seven, poverty. And number eight, tax reform. So let's go through these one at a time. This is the campaign platform, or at least the early version of the campaign platform, on which Senator Sanders is running for president. In the income and wealth inequality, he says, in the United States today, we have the most unequal wealth and income distribution of any major country on Earth, worse than at any time since the 1920s. This is an economy that must be changed in fundamental ways. Your thoughts, sir?
I just don't know how he's going to direct that through government policy.
Roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
Unless he's going to go back to picking winners and losers, which is basically what socialism is, would hope that
that's a lousy cliche, Neil, and that's not true. You know that.
When
government picks winners and no, seriously,
scary.
this is something that you would probably agree with. When government picks winners or losers, it is almost always because the winners lobbied government more effectively than the losers. And that is, you know, a corruption of our government brought to us by the Supreme Court.
Yes, Tom. But then the second step of that is that if we take that power to pick winners and losers away from the government, we basically disenfranchise the tax break brokers and the lobbyists.
No, what you do is you give that power to the very richest. Now you're in a situation where it's the, you know, bella omnium et omnia, to quote Thomas Jefferson, the war of all against all, and it becomes the richest win. They set the rules. That's what happens. You know, the only thing that can constrain the great power of enormous wealth is. You know, the collective power of all the people in the country, in other words, the government. So, as I said, I think that Bernie's way of dealing with income inequality is to roll back the Reagan tax cuts or some variation thereon, because we didn't have this income inequality before 35 years of Reaganism.
Well, I mean, part of that's a function of tremendous economic growth, but also
no, it's
want
not.
To stop protecting.
We grew faster in the 40s and 50s than we're growing now.
When we had an economic crisis in 2008, 2009, you know, Washington, D.C. protected wealth. And so that's really where your inequality comes from.
No, I agree. You know, when George W. Bush passed two TARPs in a row and a stimulus bill, and it all went to rich people and banks, it was wrong. I'm with you.
All right. And who else would it go to? I mean, that's all.
How about people with mortgages they can't pay? I mean, why did the Republicans take away long-term unemployment benefits from people?
No, it's I think if you stopped protecting wealth, I think it would go a great way to creating inequality, because those, you know, you have people who are manning oars and then you have passengers. A lot of those passengers are very wealthy people protected by the system. It's almost feudalism. And so I would consider maybe your first step would be get rid of the protections for those people.
Such as?
Well, I mean, it's like don't do TARPs anymore. And
I see.
You know, get rid of these sort of the cozy relationships between the regulators and the industry.
Okay, well, I can't speak for Bernie, but I you know, as somebody who agrees with his platform, I don't disagree with that. So then, income and wealth inequality, we may approach it differently. You don't want to do it with taxes, but
I support the goal.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fine. Let's move on to jobs and income.
Sure.
He says, in my view, we need a massive federal jobs program that puts millions of people back to work. We must end our disastrous trade policies. We need to raise the minimum wage to a living wage, and we have to fight for pay equity for women.
No, those are all pipe dreams. I mean, because it's the government spends so much more on the jobs because you have all the administrators and bureaucrats and hacks associated. So for every $50,000 job building a road, this how many bureaucrats have to touch that thing? I mean, it's
well, if you look at the overhead
the sector,
if you look, typically overhead in the federal government runs around 2 or 3%. In the private sector, typically overhead runs anywhere from 12 to 30%. But
yeah,
number
but,
one,
yeah,
but
Tom, I,
but
I've
so so you're
time.
Saying you're saying that what FDR did, putting the millions of Americans back to work after the last time Republicans crashed the economy in 1929, that was not successful, that we shouldn't be emulating that, we shouldn't learn from that.
Well, I think that we got a lot of benefit from the Works Projects Administration.
Right, what Bernie is suggesting. Why don't we just do that again? We got a whole, you know, look at Baltimore. You got a whole city, you know, that's with a mind-boggling unemployment rate. Let's create jobs for those people. It's not like we don't have $3 trillion worth of infrastructure that needs to be fixed.
Well, if you're going to pay somebody $30,000, $40,000 in welfare benefits, why not have them start cleaning up the alleys and streets of Baltimore? I mean,
first of all, I don't know anybody making $30,000 or $40,000 in welfare. But beyond that, it sounds like what you're saying is the same thing FDR said, which is the same thing that I can't say that Bernie's ever said this, but I think he would probably agree with the sentiment that the best welfare program is a job.
Absolutely. But the problem, Tom, is that as you and I speak and as you and I even agree, once Congress gets a hold of these highway job programs, they become boondoggles. And I'm speaking as somebody who grew up in the Boston area, you know, of the $20 billion spent to build the big dig, I mean, how many permanent jobs were created? Zero, except if you count the toll collectors.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
but
a lot of people, that was sold.
No, I disagree. I disagree, Neil. If the big dig was successful in reducing the traffic problems in Boston, and I used to travel, I lived in New Hampshire. I've spent in aggregate probably, you know, half a year in Boston, at least in Boston traffic. If the big dig helped solve the, you know, part of the traffic problem in Boston, then it did create jobs and it continues to create jobs. That's the whole point of infrastructure.
No. I'll dial that back, Tom. But,
okay.
But,
all right. Let's move on to campaign finance reform because we just have a minute and a half left.
Sorry.
Bernie says, as a result, Citizens United, American democracy is being undermined by the ability of the Koch brothers and other billionaire families. These wealthy contributors can literally buy politicians. We need to overturn Citizens United.
No way.
So you like that billionaires are, you know, like over the weekend it came out that Marco Rubio has his own private billionaire. Therefore, he's taking seriously as a Republican candidate that without a billionaire, you can't be a serious candidate for president of the United States. You think that that's a good thing?
I don't know if that's true. And
it's in the New York Times. I mean, they quoted Marco Rubio.
There would be no Eugene McCarthy campaign if it wasn't for like three very wealthy men. I don't know if they might be billionaires today. It's just, you know, it should be decided on ideas. You can spend $1 billion on a candidate.
If it should be decided on ideas, Neil, then you're talking about campaign finance reform, aren't you? Rather than decided on who writes the biggest check.
I have a problem with the government supporting candidates running for the government and then some bureaucrat getting quarterly reports and
So we're back to the default conservative position that you trust billionaires more than you trust our elected representatives and the people who elect them.
I trust the American people to make the right decision, however the information comes to them.
Okay, that sounds nice, but if it's only going to come to them via billionaires, what have you got? You've got
a plutocracy. Yeah, but there's a lot of billionaires on the left that are very successful in moving political agendas.
I think
billionaires are pushing Keystone.
I would love to see more than one or two of them. Actually, no, I wouldn't. I think the whole system is rotten. Neil McCabe. TheWashingtonMercury.com. Thank you, Neil.
All right, be good.
Good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. We didn't get through the whole agenda, but anyhow, we'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Victor in Milwaukee, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV system. Hey, Victor, what's up? Victor? No, he's not listening to his telephone. Let's try John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Yeah, to just make a comment on, that New York Times story, revelation about the beauticians that are exposed to all these chemicals, but also they're like slave laborers. It's like indentured servitude. And I think that reveals a lot more deeper issue. And I think there is a big intersection between, what we do economically, politically, economically, and what we believe in. And unfortunately, the best of wisdom from either philosophy or any of our religious traditions is just completely ignored almost for the sake of, creating more and more wealth. And I'm really glad that you're visiting Schumacher College in England, because E.F. Schumacher recognized this. He was an economist, a professional economist. He studied under John Maynard Keynes. And, Keynesian's view was very materialistic. He really did think that, he even stated that, greed and avarice must be our gods for another 100 years until we create, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially that's what he said, was that they have to be our gods until we have enough wealth created that we can all share in on it. We can all be millionaires, I guess. Yeah. And, this is devastating to all of us, because people end up being treated as a commodity, and it just goes against the grain of who we are. These systems of religion and philosophy developed before the Enlightenment, and let's make the Enlightenment a success. I don't want to reject it like Dostoevsky and crawl into some monastery.
It's not just Dostoevsky, John. The entire Republican Party is rejecting the Enlightenment.
Yeah, well, they really are, because they're not optimistic. This is a very optimistic worldview.
Well, not only that, the Enlightenment was science-based, and they're saying, there's no such thing as climate change, no such thing as evolution. The Enlightenment was egalitarian, and the Republicans are saying, no, we've got to suppress the vote.
We need to use our minds to be fair. We need to use our minds to create, we can't just crawl into our own little poverty-stricken worlds and just wait for death. I think that God meant us to use our talents for good, and whether it's through science, whether it's through anything. Am I still on the air?
You are.
Oh, okay. It was so silent in here.
I was listening.
Oh, okay. Well, I think that this is, this philosophy that has been perpetrated on us is really cruel. Ayn Randian and
I agree. It is an absolutely brutal philosophy that pure and simple, all it does is justify greed, and it's destroying this country. It's destroying the world, frankly, in my opinion. Thank you, John. Thank you for the call. I'm totally, totally solidly agree with you. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman program. Matt in Weaverville, North Carolina. Hey, Matt, what's up? Thanks for listening to 880 AM.
Hey, Tom. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I'm calling because in the first hour you kind of wondered aloud why it is that Barack Obama is supporting the TPP. And I wanted to call and tell you that there was this little-known meeting at the inaugural meeting of the Alexander Hamilton Project in the Brookings Institution. And if you Google Obama and Alexander Hamilton Project, you'll find a video of then-Senator Barack Obama giving a speech. And Larry Summers was there, and Robert Rubin was there. And he was basically saying that, the project's purpose is to promote free trade. And he was basically saying that there's a lot of people who oppose free trade, and but he seemed to imply that, or he stated straight out that, that the folks in that room knew better, that, that free trade was really ultimately the thing that had to happen. And even though it was going to cause some suffering in the short term for workers, that it had to go forward. It was like imperative.
That is so bizarre, because Alexander Hamilton was the author of the anti-free trade, you know, program, the tariff program that George Washington put into place in 1793.
Yeah, I know, it's kind of a sad irony.
It's an astonishing irony.
I know that. I think the last caller was, you know, I'm on when I was on held over. Maybe the broadcast listeners didn't hear, but he was talking about how capitalism has become, the moral force that seems to displace all other moralities and ethics. And I think that that's exactly right. I think what we've got is a world where it's kind of like a computer program with a pattern logic in it, and it punishes certain things and rewards other things. And it just happens over and over and over and over in this iterative process.
Yeah.
And it generates certain kinds of results, and it suppresses other results. And
yeah.
And I think, you know, most people have bought into a worldview that is essentially transactional. It's all about buying,
all about
and selling,
the
and exchange.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you, Matt. And there's no conversation about the rules of the game anymore. We used to understand that, you know, the marketplace. There's no such thing as a free market. Marketplaces are created by governments. Currency is created by government. The rules of the game of the marketplace are created by government. The courts that enforce those rules are created, and the jails are created by government. Governments establish marketplaces and the rules of the marketplace. And the rules of the marketplace, historically, before Reaganism, the rule of the marketplace was, you know, it's fine if you want to make a profit, it's fine if you want to get rich, but you have to do it in a way that benefits our country and our communities. And since Reaganism, the ideal has been, go ahead, get rich, make as much money as you can, to hell with your workers, to hell with the community, to hell with the country, just make that money. Because greed is good, and if you operate out of a place of maximum greed, you will benefit and society will benefit. And this is the pitch, this is the sales pitch that Ayn Rand lays out in her novels. This is the sales pitch that Milton Friedman was promoting. This is the sales pitch that von Mises was promoting. And it's a lie. We have seen over and over and over again that it's a lie. Yes, there's value in the profit motive. I am not a capitalist, but I certainly engage in free enterprise. I have owned 7 businesses, probably more than that, but 7 consequential businesses in my life, started every one of them. And this show is one of them. And sure, you know, we would like to make money, but, or at least make a decent salary. But that is a completely different thing from having national policy defined by this theology of the marketplace. It is absolutely bizarre. Matt, excellent point, and I'll have to track that down. Thank you. Alexander Hamilton and Barack Obama, I'll check it out. John in Portland, listening on X-Ray FM. Hey, John, what's up? John?
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. And see what you think. And maybe I missed a lot of Bernie's speeches, but I think Bernie is, and we as progressives are making a big mistake when the first words, in my opinion, out of Bernie's mouth should be, I am a capitalist and I am for free enterprise system. I'm also,
well, he's
a
not a capitalist.
Socialist.
Hang on just a second, John. He's not a capitalist. He doesn't live off income derived from investments. That's a capitalist.
Right, but so many people in the USA are so brainwashed by this garbage media we have, especially TV, that you know darn well, Tom, that the Republicans are going to tag, first thing, Bernie, he's a socialist. They're not going to mention
him. Did you see him with Bob Schieffer this weekend on the Face of the Nation?
No, I'm sorry. I gave up.
Schieffer introduced him as a socialist, and his first question was, how can you be a socialist running in the United States? There's no way that Bernie can avoid the fact that he ran for mayor of Burlington on the Socialist Party ticket. He dropped that and just became an independent, but he's always been very candid in saying that he's a democratic socialist, the same way that Norway is a democratic socialist country, Sweden's a democratic socialist country, Germany's a democratic socialist, France, the Denmark, Finland, they're all democratic socialist countries, and they have a better standard of life than we do. Their economies work better than ours do, and there's lessons to learn. And we have already applied democratic socialist principles in the United States. Franklin Roosevelt put most of them into place with Social Security. Lyndon Johnson brought Medicare. I mean, arguably some pieces of Obamacare, like the Medicaid expansion, that's all democratic socialism. So Bernie can't run away from that title, from that label. So what he has to do, and this is just my opinion, I'm not part of his campaign. I'm not an advisor. I know nothing, right, about what's going on that side. And that's probably a good thing. He comes on this show every week for an hour and takes calls from listeners and has done that for a decade. But I think that he has to, because he can't avoid the label, he has to educate the American people. And I encourage you, John, to track down, it's on YouTube, the video of Bernie being interviewed by Bob Schieffer this weekend on Face the Nation, because he approaches it head on. And which is what I think he has to do. I mean, I absolutely understand what you're saying, that the American people just don't know what the hell socialism means, and they think it might have something to do with the Soviet Union, which it doesn't. But this is the hand he's been dealt.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Or the hand he dealt himself. But you get the point. I mean, this is who he is. And he's simply saying, this is who I am. And if you want to know more about it, here are the details. I think that's fine. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's see here, Victor in Milwaukee. Hey, Victor, what's on your mind today?
I was wondering. About a week or two, I heard President Obama say that he would debate the TPP issue, and I haven't seen anybody do that yet. And I'm thinking, could Bernie or Elizabeth Warren debate him and one of his people, or Paul Ryan, and actually get it broadcast where people could see what his points are?
Well, here's part of the problem, Victor. It's sort of like debating, whether there's life on other planets. There's nothing to debate. They will not release the content of the TPP so that it can be debated.
But the point is, if he is actually debating as he said he would, then somebody that ought to be able to score a lot of points right there by saying, well, what is the reason? Give us some of the details.
Yeah.
And if you can't give us the details, just the point that they would have to hide these issues, I don't think would look good. So the question is, either he just said that to say it, but if you actually did get him on a debate and he kept saying, well, I can't say this or I can't say that, that itself would look bad.
Yeah. What astonishes me is the amount of political capital and effort that he's putting into this compared to something like, public option for the ACA, which was blown up by one vote. Basically, Joe Lieberman was responsible for there not being a public option in the Affordable Care Act. And I truly believe that if President Obama had given half as many speeches as he's given on the TPP, he could have blown Joe Lieberman out of the water. And he's taking on Elizabeth Warren frontally. He could have done that with Joe Lieberman. He chose not to, apparently. I mean, it's just, why spend so much political capital on this? I don't get it, unless either it really is great, which I know not to be a fact because I've read parts of the leaked stuff, from WikiLeaks, assuming that that's actually what it is, and it's been by and large acknowledged that that's what it is.
It would be helpful if one of them, either Elizabeth or Bernie, publicly asked him for the debate.
Yeah.
Then either he would have to turn him down or ignore him.
Although, you take on the president of your own party at some considerable peril, both politically and structurally is the wrong word. But, the president has the ability to punish as well as to help. So I as much as he's kicking Elizabeth Warren, I don't think she's going to kick back. Although, who knows? I don't know. We'll see. We'll see where this all goes. Victor, thanks for the call. Charles, Nopalaka, Florida. Hey, Charles, back to the police unions? Unions?
Yeah. How you doing, Tom? I was trying to get in touch with you so many times last week, but I'm glad that I'm on today.
Okay.
It just seems, I don't know what's the right word, if I can use ludicrous, disingenuous, but just plain out lying to the American public to say that the prosecutor in Baltimore you know, if it states in a conflict of interest if she wants to prosecute those police officers because she's so close to the community.
Well, I think the conflict that they suggested was that her husband is a member of the city council and that he had been outspokenly calling for the prosecution of the police before she brought forward that prosecution. And so the police union guy is saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, this is like, you know, political family grandstanding stuff. I disagree with that characterization, and I agree with what's her name? Marilyn Mosby, as I recall, the prosecutor.
And we have to look at the fact that he's probably been elected by people in that community that's had problems with the police.
Yep.
And he's representing them. But yep. Let's not overlook this one fact. There's another fact that's very crucial. If that's the case, then how can we trust police officers to actually investigate police shooting when they're so close to the officers involved? Usually they're in the same, you know, in the same department.
Exactly. So and that's why we need independent oversight boards that have the power to punish or even to indict police officers. Internal affairs apparently is not working the way it was intended.
Exactly. And then you have these conservatives saying, well, you know, we have these kids from these communities or people from these communities that are not stepping up in life and not moving up. But once you have one that's actually done something great, and in fact, they're a great power couple. You have someone on the city council, and you have someone in the district attorney, and now they're attacking those people that's actually doing something good in the community that everybody else can look up to. So, you know, on the face, it's just a bunch of crap. Now, lastly, just like I said about Bernie, if anyone attacks him for being a socialist, all he has to do is remind everyone that's been, mostly everyone that's elected in the Congress and the Senate, they're, you know, being funded by companies that also get government, you know, you might as well call it government food stamps or corporate food stamps.
Well, for that matter, they're all
as well too.
They're all government employees, so you know maybe they should all be called socialists because they're all taking a check from the government. Charles, great. It's always great to hear from you. Thank you, Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, the best way to shut these guys up about the FEMA concentration camps is to just send some reporters with cameras to some of these abandoned Walmarts and photograph the inside, and that'll shut them up. I think we can get Neil McCabe to agree that there's no profit in FEMA camps because you're locking everybody up.
Yeah.
There's way more money to be made in privatized prisons for black and Latino pot smokers.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Well said, John.
The libertarian repos, the Republicans that you mentioned earlier, that they like to cry no regulation but litigation.
Right.
Well, I think that's kind of ironic and disingenuous because in the Lone Star State where I live, yeah, the tort reform here makes it nearly impossible for you to take someone to court for damaging your family member in the hospital.
Right. Yeah, it's capped at $250,000.
They're just a bunch of hypocrites.
Right. And not only that, when tort reform went into place in Texas, which capped the amount of money that you can sue a doctor or a hospital for pain and suffering or for anything, basically, at $250,000, if my recollection of how it all worked is correct. And correct me if I'm wrong here, Johnny. But when that went into place, it was put into place with the promise that it was going to reduce insurance premiums, it was going to reduce doctors' fees because it was going to reduce malpractice insurance premiums, and in fact, it didn't reduce anything. The one thing that it did reduce was the ability of Texans like you, Johnny, to sue if you get harmed. You know, and in some cases, these harms, I mean, if an incompetent or intoxicated or addicted doctor or a badly run hospital, you know, seriously damages in a way that basically disables for the rest of their lives a child, you're looking at millions of dollars for that child to live for the next 50, 60, 80, 70 years and or longer. And it's impossible to get that money now in Texas. And it's tort reform is just another big business, you know, shill operation. You're right.
Yeah. Tort reform is a scam, just like Reagan's promise of going to 401k. Remember 401k?
Yeah.
Every single time you hear in the media 401k, and that turned out to be a big scam.
Yeah, it is. You know, that, with Reagan, it was originally IRAs, and I think the 401ks came a little later. But yeah, moving people out of pensions and moving them away from Social Security and into the stock market so that the average American would think of himself as a stock investor and be on the side of the billionaires. It's crazy. Johnny, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, about the manicurists and the chemicals they have to deal with.
Right.
I'm 52, never had a manicure in my life, but I can't imagine walking into an establishment where all the employees are in full hazmat gear with gas masks. Then I walk in off the sidewalk with no hazmat gear. That would scare the heck out of me, and I would turn around and be out the door instantly.
Yeah, I think what they're talking about doing is just radically increasing the quality and nature of the ventilation in these places.
Gotcha.
You know, because there's no shortage of noxious chemicals in a lot of workplaces, and usually they deal with it that way. But yeah, you create quite a vivid picture there, Michael. That's a good one. Thanks a lot for the call, Marty in Denver. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hello, hi, Tom. I was just calling you up here. I kind of came in midstream with your guest, and as soon as I heard that he said, no, Citizens United is, you know, all right by me, I was just like, well, that's it. I can just tell the side of the spectrum that he's coming from,
right.
Although it seemed like he was agreeing with you, at least, and you might have been agreeing with him on some of the points that possibly Bernie would bring to, you know, a debate or, you know, to, you know, campaigning for the nomination,
right.
And all. I do want to say, in terms of the manicurists, the smell in there is amazing. I take my mom in about every 6 or 8 weeks, and I never thought about it, but these ladies are there for 12 hours a day sometimes,
yeah.
Breathing in acetone fumes and yeah. Who knows what else.
Yep.
So it's endemic upon us to, you know, say, hey, we want them to be safe too.
Yeah, I'm so reactive to that stuff. Louise doesn't usually wear nail polish, but occasionally she will, you know, like going to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And I have to leave the house when she's putting it on, or at least go to another part and have a window wide open, because I just get my throat goes so raw so fast from just, you know, I mean, one person putting on fingernail polish. And then I start getting headaches from it. It's like, you know, that I can't be the only person who reacts to this stuff that way. This is nasty stuff. Marty, thanks a lot for the call. And once again, you know, the libertarians and the Republicans say, okay, cool. You know, after you've died, have your family sue. Brilliant, right? These are the rocket scientists who want to run this country. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour. Back with your calls right after this. Welcome back. Dwayne in Youngstown, Ohio. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? It's a pleasure to get in touch with you. I try to watch you and listen to you in all your forums, and you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
God bless you. What I wanted to talk about was the fact that, you know, I have people who debate me. They say, well, hey, this is this way and this is that way. But when you really look at what's going on, everything that's going on is in the Powell memo.
You're right. I wrote a book about this. It's called The Crash of 2016, and one of the opening chapters lays out the Powell memo, tells the story of Lewis Powell, and then we follow the Powell memo right through to today, how that Powell memo set up the oligarchy that is destroying our economy.
Yes, and I'd like to someone needs to come up with a movement that we can educate people about that, because, you know, very few people know this. And every time, I mean, you know, it seems like I'm the only guy around my area that's, you know, that says this. I mean, no one ever says this. You don't hear it on TV. You don't hear anything about it. And, you know, I'm glad that gentlemen like yourself and, you know, Free Speech Link, you know, because everything is owned by, you know, the oligarchs, and we're in a pretty bad shape, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, we are in extremely bad shape. In fact, the New York Times is reporting that here's the article. Hillary Rodham Clinton calls them everyday Americans. Scott Walker prefers hardworking Americans. Rand Paul says he speaks for people who work for the people who own businesses. Bernie Sanders talks about ordinary Americans. They say the once ubiquitous term middle class has gone conspicuously missing from the 2016 campaign trail. The phrase, long synonymous with the American dream, now evokes anxiety, an uncertain future, and a lifestyle that is increasingly out of reach. And then they go on to say, a social stratum that once signified a secure, aspirational lifestyle with a house in the suburbs, children set to attend college, retirement savings in the bank, and maybe an occasional trip to Disneyland, now connotes fears about falling behind, sociologists, economists, and political scientists say. This is Rubio says he's speaking for the millions and millions of Americans who aren't rich. Senator Ted Cruz says he has a message for hardworking men and women across America. In 2000, 60% of Americans identified themselves as middle class. Today, it's 51%. That's astonishing. That's like free fall, Dwayne.
It's like we need to let people know that we are in. This is a government takeover. It is. I mean, you know, and it's like, you know, it is what it is.
Or it's a takeover of the government by business, because that's what Lewis Powell laid out. He said, you know, the business community has historically been non-political, and it's time for us to get political. And this was in 1971. It was 3 or 4 months before Nixon put him on the Supreme Court. And this memo laid out, what the Powell memo led to were the think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and whatnot. It led to the Federalist Society, the right wingization of our judicial system. It led to taking over our colleges. It led to programs to take over our schools. Lewis Powell was basically, you know, we've got to get ourselves involved in every aspect of American life and get the story of the wonders of American business out there, because Ralph Nader and Rachel Carlson are hurting us. Dwayne, thanks a lot for the call. You are spot on. And we'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And Luke Vargas is in London. Do I have that right, Luke?
That's correct, Tom. Glad to be on.
And welcome back from Moscow. You were in Russia for the VE Day celebration.
That's correct. A little audio that I captured there from the square.
Yeah, we're playing in the background. Yeah. So
nothing like it.
Yeah, what's in the news today? What's on the top of your mind today?
Well, I would say we've just learned in the last few hours that John Kerry is traveling to Russia today. He is going to meet with Vladimir Putin in Sochi. This was something that was unannounced. We knew Angela Merkel was there yesterday. She did not go to those parades. But now John Kerry is going for a series of meetings with Mr. Putin. Turning here to news that directly affects the country I'm in now.
Hang on just a second. Are they going to Sochi to talk about Ukraine?
Among other things is what we've been told, in a range of other issues. Again, I believe one of those issues is going to overlap with the other big headline today that I'm looking at, particularly with my United Nations hat on, which is that of the Mediterranean migrant crisis. The UN Security Council had meetings at 10 a.m. this morning. I don't know the outcome of those meetings just yet, but it was to discuss a proposal being circulated by Great Britain that would enable a military, operation to disable the boats used by human traffickers in Libya. Russia has said in the past it thinks there should be some other way of dealing with the migrant crisis, by trying to, fight it in Africa in a way. But not through actual military intervention. So this plan to use some sort of tactical aircraft likely to disable those boats before they're loaded up with people and before they leave harbor has drawn some criticism from Russia before. It's believed, though, that the U.S. might be supportive of this policy move, which might explain why it's likely going to be added to the agenda at that meeting in Sochi. Another element of the migrant situation was talked about by the European Union today. They are evidently preparing a proposal that would institute some sort of quota system within the European Union. Basically, depending on the size of your country, you would be mandated to allow in a certain number of people, both from within the European Union, but also from without. Now, this is going to be a tough sell domestically here in the United Kingdom, namely because David Cameron has said that in or out referendum on European Union membership to be held before 2018. I'm sure he'll push it back as far as he can in 2017. But one of the big things, he wants to see occur before the referendum are reforms to Britain's membership within the European Union. He wants to, instead of what this proposal does, which is would actually increase the number of people that Great Britain would be forced to allow in, he wants to renegotiate the relationship to restrict or have Great Britain opt out of the freedom of movement from within the European Union. So there appear to be a big difference in the way these countries
are. That's really the issue, isn't it? That working class Brits are getting really, really upset with basically people from poor countries in Europe being able to come into England and take their jobs without even having to apply for a visa?
Correct. Mostly European, Eastern European, right. Domestic workers, Polish immigrants, for example. So this isn't directly related to the Mediterranean migrant crisis. But in many ways, the policy mechanisms that the European Union at a continental level wants to employ to deal with the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean would ensnare the sort of reforms that David Cameron is looking for. And it makes sense, that he's going to run into issues here with countries like Italy, like Greece, like France, where, why would they allow Great Britain to sort of opt out of one of the biggest common challenges that is being faced across the European Union just because his home population wants to see a change in immigration policy.
Right. I have a feeling they're going to have to completely pull out or not at all.
Yeah, it's very hard to see, particularly given the current political climate, where the flexibility is going to exist there. And again, it's worth pointing out that because of how large the population here is in Great Britain, this mandated number, which would be very much likely to be substantially larger than the quota that this country already, tries to maintain on limiting migration into the UK. So again, this is going to sort of really throw a wrench in those plans. We've known that, we've talked about how these British elections were sort of a poison chalice, that you win them, but you are, faced not only with trying to really stimulate British economic growth, which is still a little bit sluggish after the recession, but you've got this issue of the European Union referendum. If Labour had won, that would have been off the table, and their Prime Minister wouldn't have needed to deal with that. But it is a promise that David Cameron made. I believe it was you that put out the argument that maybe talking about that referendum before the election 2 or 3 years ago, making it almost commonly known that the one chance you get to be able to vote on whether Britain should leave the European Union is by casting your vote for the Tories. But that said, you still have to follow through. And I do believe that David Cameron sincerely wants to stay in the European Union, but the task ahead of him is getting much harder as we see this European Union policy begin to take shape.
Yeah, I mean, he's caught between two constituencies. You've got average working class Brits who are very concerned about this. And on the other hand, you've got, upper middle class and upper class Brits who are very pleased with the fact that they can now hire domestic help for half of what they used to pay. They can get the plumbing done for less than they used to pay. And you've got big corporations who are looking at a labor force that is declining in wages. They're very happy about that, too. So and then the banking, stuff that goes on between the UK and the rest of the EU that's part of the EU agreements. You got the banksters very happy with that. So they've got to be leaning on David Cameron, too.
Yeah. One thing I want to just put out before we get off air is we are looking to Yemen tonight to see if a apparently agreed upon humanitarian ceasefire will go into effect.
Right.
It's worth pointing out that this is humanitarian. This is not because the military situation has changed. We're crossing our fingers. This would be really important to allow much needed aid to get into the country. So we hope both sides will put down their weapons tonight.
Cool. Luke Vargas with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
Great talking. It's the top of the hour here. We'll be back right after the news with more of the amazing stuff going on in the United States and the world right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In today's New York Times, an interesting piece about how basically the middle class in America, the American dream. See, before Reaganism kicked in, the American dream in the United States was to have basically my dad's life. My dad came back from World War II. He actually joined during the war, and it ended while he was in basic training, and so he was part of the Japanese occupation for 2 years. He came back from that and on the GI Bill went to college, and with the GI Bill was able to buy a home at a 2.5% or 3% interest rate, a little $15,000 house in Lansing, Michigan. And that American dream. And you know, he had a pension when he died in 2006. He had his house paid off. Every 2 or 3 years, Dad would buy a new car. He had a good job. He raised four boys. He helped us out in a lot of ways. He was there. My mom didn't work. In fact, my mom gave up her driver's license after, I think, one of my brothers was born. I mean, she just quit driving altogether. So what happened to the American middle class? Well, I would say, it's insane trade agreements have largely destroyed our middle class. And Reaganism has destroyed our middle class. I mean, the middle class didn't pretty much exist in the United States until the 1930s. Franklin Roosevelt created the rules of the game of the marketplace, so that a middle class could emerge, and a middle class did emerge. The strongest in the world, the healthiest in the world, the most vital in the world, the wealthiest in the world at the time. And then came along Reaganomics. And 35 years of Reaganism now, here's what the New York Times had to say about this. Hillary Rodham Clinton calls them everyday Americans. Scott Walker prefers hardworking taxpayers. Rand Paul calls... Only Rand Paul, right? The crazy guy, the crazy libertarian. Nobody is anybody unless you can relate them to a billionaire or a rich person. So if they work for a rich person, then they're worthy of mentioning. But if they don't, we can forget about them. So Rand Paul says that he speaks for, quote, people who work for the people who own businesses. Anyway. They say the once ubiquitous term middle class has gone conspicuously missing from the 2016 campaign trail. Senator Marco Rubio says he speaks for the millions and millions of people who aren't rich. No, they're poor, thanks to Republican policies. Bernie Sanders talks about working families and people working full time. Ted Cruz, although I've heard Bernie Sanders use middle class a lot, and Ted Cruz talks about hardworking men and women across America. Nobody wants to say middle class. Why? Well, according to Gallup, just, from 2000 to 2008, 60% of Americans identified themselves as middle class. The general definition of middle class is considered to be somebody earning between roughly $30,000 or $35,000 and on the low end and $100,000 on the high end, or a family, a household income between $30,000 and $100,000. 60% of Americans identified themselves as a middle class, which includes a lot of people making less than 30 and a lot of people making over 100, because people don't, you know, it's like, hey, American dream. Last year, 51%. That's a 9% drop in the number of Americans who say that they're middle class. That is a country in free fall. As the author of this New York Times piece wrote, the title is, As Middle Class Fades, So Does the Use of the Term on the Campaign Trail. I don't have the author. I'm sorry. The New York Times has a bug right now in their printing software, and it just comes out. Their headlines and subheads come out as gibberish. But whoever wrote this wrote, a social stratum that once signified a secure aspirational lifestyle. See, this is my dad's generation and all the people I knew, frankly. I mean, you know, I grew up in a lower middle class neighborhood in the southern part of Lansing, Michigan, South Lansing. In a subdivision of row homes, or not row homes, a subdivision of, you know, individual of small houses. You know, I grew up in a 1-3-bedroom house with one bathroom and a basement. And I lived in the basement most of the time. And that's where my dad had his library. He had his 20,000 books down there. A social stratum that once signified a secure, aspirational lifestyle with a house in the suburbs, children set to attend college, retirement savings in the bank, and maybe an occasional trip to Disneyland. And see, my dad got all that. He had to drop out of college after 2 years because mom got pregnant with me. And so he ended up getting a job at Lansing Tool and Die at this Tool and Die shop. And boom, it was a union shop. Suddenly my dad was in the middle class. And maybe an occasional trip to Disneyland, the social stratum, now connotes fears about falling behind, sociologists, economists, and political scientists say. This is where we're at. The middle class is dying, thanks to Reaganism, and the free trade associated with it, and the giant tax cuts associated with it that let all that wealth go to the top, and of course Reagan's increases of taxes on the middle class. So then over at Common Dreams, Paul Buchheit writes a piece called Why the Rich Don't Care About Jobs for the Rest of Us. He says, many of us wonder what possible reason could exist for the failure to invest in American infrastructure to create millions of jobs as a result. Analysis reveals personality traits and beliefs and misconceptions that might account for such behavior. Here's a look inside the billion-dollar brain. He says, number one, it's all about me. He's quoting scientific studies that upper-class individuals tend to be narcissistic with a clear sense of entitlement. Worse yet, they believe their talents and attributes, genius even, have earned them a rightful position of status over everyone else. And, according to another study, the American sense of entitlement has been growing over the past 30 years. Number two, it's all about lazy people who refuse to work, right? In other words, this is the message they put out. Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, both likened the safety net to a hammock. Louis Gohmert says, People who are on a $5 a day food stamp budget shouldn't be able to buy food crab legs. Well, they're not anyway. John Boehner said, this idea that's been born that, you know, I don't have to work. I think I'd rather just sit around. Right. It's a lie. He says, but in 2011, Senate Republicans killed a proposed $447 billion jobs bill that would have added about 2 million jobs to the economy. The Republicans, members of Congress, filibustered Nancy Pelosi's Preventing of Outsourcing Act, even as millions of jobs are being outsourced, and they temporarily blocked the Small Business Jobs Act. In 2013, April, only one member of Congress bothered to even show up for a hearing on unemployment. When asked what he would do to bring jobs to Kentucky, Mitch McConnell said, that's not my job. What? You're the senator from Kentucky. Number three, it's all about waiting for the free market to work its magic. Right. Yeah, that free market thing. And number four, the rich don't care about creating jobs. They don't. And then, on top of that, throw in a healthy dose of racism, which is endemic in American society. Michelle Obama talking about it over the weekend. We'll get into that a little more a little later on. And Paul Ryan, about a year ago, this Steve Bannon writing over at the Matto blog on MSNBC. About a year ago, Representative Paul Ryan made provocative comments about inner-city men who are not even thinking about working or learning the value and the culture of work. Right. Maybe that's because there's no jobs in the inner city because of our insane trade policies and Reaganism that Paul Ryan advocates. But in the same interview, Ryan referenced Charles Murray. Then Jeb Bush praised Charles Murray twice at the National Review Ideas Summit. He says, my views were shaped a lot by Charles Murray's book. I like Charles Murray's books, to be honest with you. Senator Rand Paul cited Charles Murray. So who the hell is Charles Murray? He's the co-author of this book called The Bell Curve that suggests that people with darker skin have lower IQs. So now you've got racism being used as a justification for destroying the middle class, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, racism has always been the justification for preventing, frankly, a widespread emergence of an African-American middle class or a Latino middle class. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Mark, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've been sitting here with a seven-point rant for some time. It's nice to hear you. I hope you have time to get all these, but I'm wondering, do we have a progressive version of the Lewis Powell memo? And if not, why not?
I think we do in Bernie's here? In Bernie's platform. I think you do.
Yeah, I heard his Sister Giant presentation the other day. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
The conservatives have had a long, medium, and short-term strategy for a long time, and I don't think the progressive side has, and I think we need to have that.
Mm-hmm.
My recollection of middle-class destruction begins around 1970, when I graduated from college a couple of years before you. Mm-hmm. You know, Vietnam was there, a whole bunch of baby boomers came out of college and went, where are the jobs? And they weren't there.
Right.
And then Nixon decides to let healthcare become for profit.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, that was horrible.
Yeah, pushing the law that set up HMOs. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that then healthcare really started to rise in cost.
Right.
I remember NPR, what happened. I was living in Minnesota at the time in graduate school, and it was really a great network.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Susan Stamberg, I think she was interviewing Newt Gingrich, and she said, he said, oh, we're going to defund you. And she said, you can't, we're too big. Well, I think big money took over NPR.
Yeah, I agree. I think only 7% of NPR's budget now is coming from federal funds.
Oh, yeah, it was a great network. Anyway, point six, the Republicans consider all taxes as bad. They're waste, they're garbage. And, you know, of course, it's not true. Taxes are true.
I don't think that's true, Mark, because I think the Republicans cheered when Reagan doubled the payroll tax on working people making less than $35,000 a year.
Oh, yeah, and he threw all the mental health care people out of, you know, he closed all those clinics, threw them out on the street.
Yep.
Anyway, I wondered if, you know, the Republicans always refer to the Democrats as, you know, tax and spend liberals. What if we refer to the Republicans as tax and debt Republicans or spend and debt Republicans?
Yeah, well, that's what they've always been.
Do you think that would be good?
Probably not, because it suggests that
taxes are investments.
Yeah.
You know, you're fading out on me here. I can't quite hear you.
Oh, sorry, Mark. My concern with that, A, I don't think it'll stick. I've been trying that rant for a long time. And B, it buys into the basically lie. And Paul Krugman has done a great job of pushing back on this over the last couple of years, that our national debt is something that we should be hysterical about. And it's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's in fact, we should, in my opinion, we should be increasing our national debt during time of recession to put people to work, to get money into their pockets. If the Republican efforts to kill the economy had not been so successful over the past 6 years, you know, like I said, filibustering Nancy Pelosi's bill to stop outsourcing, for example, if they hadn't been not so successful and the economy had grown in a healthy way, in other words, from the bottom up, there would have then Social Security would be just fine. Medicare would be just fine. You know, we would have much more tax revenue because, frankly, that's all paid for by people, you know, in the quote middle class. You know, and people making under $118,000 a year. Mark, great agenda. Thank you very much for the call. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour. Your media support group for We the People, the Tom Harbin Program, and Jim in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was just picking up the paper. I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist, and I hate that. I really hate that. But here it is. And I've been noticing this. I see it pop up everywhere. Not just this issue, but so many other issues over the last 30 or 40 years since Reagan was in office. But I picked up this article this morning in the paper, and it's from the Associated Press, and it was feeling unwell. Carter cuts short his visit to Guyana. Now, that's not the issue, but the issue was that in that down towards the bottom, it says something about Carter going there, what reason he went there, and it says it's been watched since the English-speaking former British colony in South America moved from socialism to democracy 23 years ago. That's apples and oranges. And they slipped that in there, and I think it's intentional to create a mindset that there's that socialism and democracy are opposites.
Where was this, Jim?
Contrary. This was Associated Press released this. It was in the local newspaper.
Huh.
This is syndicated.
Yeah.
Now you will see this pop up everywhere probably, and watch for television where they'll say that they'll put it right in the script.
Right.
Okay. They slip this in to try to shift people away from, you know, knowing that socialism and democracy are two different things. One's an economic system, one's a political system.
Right.
But they try to there's a way of changing the mindset of the population, and you can do it. You can pay anybody to say anything. You can pay movie companies to change their script and introduce a certain idea.
Sure.
They do this.
Tobacco companies did that for decades.
Yeah, you know that. They've been
it's called product placement. You can place ideas as well as products. You're right.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll notice that in the 80s, Reagan started giving a tax credit for movies and television to show the villains as being drug people or drug dealers, okay?
Mm.
And you saw Miami Vice and this whole slew of film production. And this is trying to change the mindset of the people. It's very diabolical. It is very totalitarian in its inception originally.
Yeah.
And this has been happening probably ever since the birth of the nation.
Here's the flip side of that, Jim, that we're also struggling with in the United States. You point out correctly that socialism is, by and large, an economic system, although democratic socialism is a political system, and that democracy is a political system. The other confusion that Americans have is between capitalism and democracy. I would say that one of the missions of organizations like the former Charles Koch Foundation, the Cato Foundation, the Cato Institute, some of these other right-wing think tanks, is to conflate democracy and capitalism so that Americans think that if you are anti-capitalist, or you think that capitalism in any way should be even slightly regulated, that you are thus an opponent of small d democracy, or even the United States, which is absolute and utter nonsense, because capitalism, again, is an economic system. Democracy is a political system.
Yeah, they tie it to freedom. If capitalism ties to freedom, there's a connection there. I don't know, but there's
The freedom. It's the freedom to boss their employees around. It's the freedom to sell products that kill people. I mean, look at these women in New York, the manicurists.
We can go ask Frank Luntz. Freedom sells.
Say what?
We can go ask Frank Luntz.
And I'm sure that Frank Luntz has handed off a lot of this stuff. It's incredible. Jim, thanks for the call. Dave in Central Nebraska. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. My wife, as you may remember, is chemically sensitive, and so she's had a problem with all kinds of cosmetics. And there is a product out there. It's a whole line of products made by Suncoat. Just like it sounds, Suncoat.
Right.
And they have a water-based nail polish and all sorts of cosmetics.
So they work just fine. They just take a lot longer to dry than the ones that are filled with volatile hydrocarbons like acetone.
I wouldn't say a lot longer to dry. I would say they're very temporary. I mean, they won't last more than an evening.
Oh, I see.
No, and they're not the hard coat that you'll get with the regular paints.
Right, right. Very interesting, Dave. Thanks for that. Thanks for the heads up on that. Alan in Baird, Delaware. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I listened to many, many times about this $15 an hour thing in Seattle, Washington, mm-hmm. and I think it's great. But what I've also heard is that like the rents are going up tremendously in that area.
Yeah, that was long before the minimum wage got raised. The rents are going up because Seattle has invested in their infrastructure. It's a very progressive town. And as the and thus it's more desirable for businesses to move there and to grow there. And the consequence of that is that that brings in more high income people. High income people tend to bid up the price of housing. We're seeing the same thing here in Washington, D.C.
You don't think that has anything to do with the $15 minimum wage going?
No, it long preceded that.
Know that they have more money and they're just charging more?
No, it long preceded that. Plus that minimum wage, you know, that's not at the part of the economy where you see the substantial increases in rents. It's the, you know, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 a month places where you're seeing, at least here in D.C., where you're seeing the rents go up substantially, not the $400, $500, $600 a month places.
I would love to hear from your listeners up in that area to see what they have to say. I really would.
Sure. Well,
thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. You just put out the call. But you know, I can tell you this is basically one of the Republican talking points is that if you give people more pay, they will have more money, and so the local landlords will jack up their rent. Now, the argument actually assumes that landlords are predatory parasites rather than that there's a marketplace, or that the marketplace is defined by the ability of people to pay, which to a certain extent is true. But what happens is that people move in and out of that marketplace. It's not people being static in it. So, yeah. Anyhow, we'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Beware of Republican talking points from friendly-sounding voices. We'll be back. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the sane left among us. Steve in Seattle. Hey, Steve, you wanted to reply to the previous caller's semi-assertion that if the minimum wage goes up, the rent goes up?
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. I've lived here a long time in this area, and he's totally wrong, and I know that for a fact because the rent has been going up in Seattle for at least the last 10 years. It's been skyrocketing, and this minimum wage law is like brand new, you know?
Right.
And you were right. Part of the reason that they've been going up is because of infrastructure. But that's drawing in corporations
Right, it's a desirable place to be.
City. But unfortunately, it's not utopia. It's starting to get to be too big, and there's huge corporations like Amazon.com there that are just taking over. That's what, you know, it's like taking over the whole city.
They're sucking up so much space that might have otherwise been residential that it's decreasing housing stock? Is that what you mean?
Well, yeah.
Or they're bringing people into work?
The place is growing very quickly.
Yeah. Okay.
That would be my opinion.
Yeah.
But I know it has nothing to do with the rent. I mean, with that,
minimum wage law. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Steve, thank you very much for that. Randy in Bellingham, Washington, listening to KBAI, you wanted to jump in on the same topic?
Hi, Tom. I live about 100 miles north of Seattle, pretty good-sized city, about 100,000 people. Fully 60% of the people in my city rent. And the reason rent is going up in my area is because people can't afford to buy a house.
Mm.
And the high rent makes it impossible to save the down payment for the house.
Right.
It's kind of a vicious circle. And the reason this all came about is some years ago, the city fathers or leaders decided to switch from a manufacturing to a retail economy, built a mall, Walmart, lots of big retail stores. What this resulted in was a lot of just low-paying retail jobs. And so people, all they can do is afford to rent, and they can never afford the down payment.
Right. Yeah, this is what George Bush and Bill Clinton referred to as the new economy.
Right.
Not so new and not so much of an economy.
Right. So that's what I wanted to say.
Okay.
So.
Thank you, Randy. You said it very well. I appreciate the call. I'm going to get back to your calls in just a second here, but I did want to share with you, I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, and it took me a while to get the time to sit down and mark up this article. This is from The Guardian. Michelle Obama over the weekend spoke at, I believe she was the commencement speaker at one of the historically African-American colleges. And she warned the mostly black graduates, mainly black graduates. She warned them of the daily slights. This is by Damian Gale and agencies in the Guardian. The daily slights they would face throughout their lives in the U.S. This is, you know, the idea of microaggressions. I believe Michelle Alexander rolled that out in her book, The New Jim Crow. But there are other parents to that phrase. She said these age-old problems are stubborn and they haven't fully gone away. She's being very generous in referring to them as age-old problems. I would say racism and white privilege. And then she talks about, you know, as potentially the first African-American first lady. Well, she wasn't potential. Oh, this is during the campaign. In 2008, she said, I was also the focus of another set of questions and speculations, sometimes rooted in the fears and misperceptions of others, which is another way, again, a very elegant way of saying the racism of the white base in the Republican Party in writ large and even in the Democratic Party. She says, was I too loud or too angry or too emasculating, or was I too soft, too much of a mom, not enough of a career woman? She talks about the New Yorker cover in 2008 that portrayed, remember, you know, where Obama's wearing the kind of a little cap and he's got a machine gun and Michelle's got this giant afro and they're doing the terrorist fist bump. She said it was a cartoon drawing of me with a huge afro and a machine gun. Now, yeah, it was satire, but if I'm really being honest, it knocked me back a bit. It made me wonder just how are people seeing me. She goes on to talk about how when Fox News said that she was her husband's crony of color and that she was Obama's baby mama, which is slang in the United States for an unwed mother. She talked about the media having accused her of a little bit of uppityism and that celebratory fist bump with her husband as a terrorist fist jab. That came out of Fox News, as I recall. Back in those days, she said, I had a lot of sleepless nights worrying about what people thought of me. She said, the road ahead is not going to be easy. She's talking to these black graduates. It never is, especially for folks like you and me, because while we've come so far, the truth is that those age-old problems, again, she's being diplomatic in her language, white racism, let's just call it that, those age-old problems are stubborn and they haven't fully gone away. So there will be times when you feel like folks look right past you or they just see a fraction of who you really are. They don't know that part of you. Instead, they'll make assumptions about who you are based on their limited notion of the world. It can feel isolating. It can make you feel like your life somehow doesn't matter. And as we've seen over the last few years, those feelings are real. They're rooted in decades of structural challenges. Again, you know, diplomatic talk for white racism that have made too many folks feel frustrated and invisible. Brilliant. I have so much respect for Michelle Obama. I got to tell you, I just have so much respect for her. Matt in Seminole, Florida. Hey, Matt, you've got a problem with Rick Scott down there now?
Well, yeah, I do. I was in reading the paper the other day, and first, before I get into, I want to ask you a question because you've been, I've been hearing the word socialism a lot lately. Your whole segment today, isn't that considered like a bad word for Republicans? That
yes.
Republicans say.
Yes. Yeah. Republicans hate the word.
Well, one of the things I read in the paper was that we're not going to take the Medicaid expansion because Rick Scott will not take it.
Right.
So his proposed solution would be to give less money to the hospitals that are making more of a profit and more money to the less profitable hospitals. Now
that is not his solution.
Is it?
That is not his solution. It is? Well, Chano?
It's actually in the paper. That was one of the suggestions to start funneling money away from the more profitable hospital.
So take from those who have and give to those who haven't. That's Rick Scott's solution.
With the hospitals, yes, it was in the Tampa Bay Times this Sunday.
So he's come out as a socialist.
That he doesn't say he's a socialist, but isn't that a socialist stance?
Well, you know, it's almost a Marxist stance, actually, which is way beyond socialism. What's the expression from is it the Communist Manifesto or Kapital? You know, from those who can. Oh man, it's been so many years since I used to know this. You know, to each according to his needs, from each according to his means. There you go. Thank you, Shino.
Oh
yeah.
Well, that's even worse than I thought, because I'm sure that the people, the elderly who voted for him, didn't exactly have this in mind.
Right.
I
mean, socialism for the hospitals.
He has to fill a $2.2 billion hole that he can't fill because of a program called LIP, low income pool. Yeah, low income pool.
Yeah.
Where he no longer can. They're not no longer to give him that money because they have Obamacare and Medicaid expansion.
Right, that program expired with the ACA.
And he went to Washington and came back with nothing, and now that's his latest thing. It's like, okay, well, let's do this Marxist.
He's doing anything he can to avoid, quote, taking Obamacare money. It's nuts. It's
completely nuts.
He's calling it profit sharing. Hysterical. Matt, I gotta dig into this a little more so I can speak intelligently about it. But thanks for the heads up, for the flag on it. I will look into it. Appreciate the call. Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, I want to touch on a big elephant in the room that really deals with police brutality and probably the root of American culture with violence. When America was born, I think it was born bipolar. You had the founding fathers saying, yes, we believe in freedom, democracy, but yet we still need to continue slavery.
And the oppression of women.
If you're knowledgeable about psychology and stuff, if you could put America on the couch, how would you solve this problem that could probably start in humanity if we don't solve this conflict between freedom and the dictatorship of capitalism? Your comment. Thanks for all you do.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Jesse. Here's the problem as I see it. This country was birthed in genocide. We slaughtered Native Americans. We were birthed in genocide. And then the white Europeans who came over here, who birthed this country, decided, A, to keep women from having the vote. That went on for, geez, almost 200 years. I mean, it wasn't until 1920. So number one, keep women under their thumbs. And number two, and you could flip these, but, you know, it took women longer to get the vote than African Americans. And number two, you know, initiated slavery. You know, became a major part of our economy. Those two original sins continue to haunt our society. And until we have seriously cleaned this up, and Lyndon Johnson started this process with the Great Society and doesn't get anywhere near enough credit for it, cut poverty in half in 6 years in the United States, particularly in communities of color. But, you know, ever since then, everybody's been committed to rolling back the Great Society.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But America has to have some sort of a reconciliation with its racist, genocidal past. We pretend it didn't exist. Welcome back. Chuck in Mosier, Oregon. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Top of the week to you.
Thank you. Back at you, Chuck. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Yeah, I was listening with CBS channel last night, and it was about 10:30 at night. And a commercial came on, and they were pushing the TPP.
Right, I've seen them.
And this one here, when they signed off at the end, maybe it was during the commercial too, but they said, we've always been involved, the country's always been involved with fair trade. They've hijacked the language.
Wow. I hadn't noticed that ad. That's not good. Yeah, that's not good news. I'll have to look around.
Obama was just here. It was the day after Obama was here. When he left, they started running these ads.
Hmm. I wonder if there's a... Oh, of course there's a relationship between the two. Plus, Ron Wyden has taken all kinds of heat. He's the senator from Oregon. He's taking all kinds of heat for co-sponsoring the fast-track bill. So,
right, and the guy, and the face in the ad was one of these bright, shiny, you know, slicked back hair guys looking like he was selling, you know, Mercedes.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Chuck, thanks for the call and the heads up on that. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV. Two Oregon calls back to back. Huh. What's up, Ed? Ed? No, Ed. Let's try Liz, watching Free Speech TV in West Hollywood, California. Liz? Can you hear me?
Oh, hi. Yes, I was just trying to get the name of the lady who camped outside of George Bush's house in Texas.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan. In fact, yeah. I stood outside George Bush's house in Texas with Cindy Sheehan with a bullhorn calling him a war criminal. There's pictures of it over at TomHartman.com, I'm pretty sure. Anyhow, back to you, Liz.
Well, anyway, I thought we need to have a movement like that. We target certain people like the Koch brothers or the Koch brothers, as they should be really called, because...
Well, people should get to determine how to pronounce their own names.
Shelley Edelson, is that his name? But not 10 people, not 20 people, not 100 people, but thousands of people bring busloads of low-income homeless people. And so what if they get arrested? At least they get a good warm bed for the night and a free meal out of it, right? But have all these people camp outside of their house to bring attention to the need in this country.
Yeah. Here's the problem, Liz. This is the problem we had trying to be in front of George Bush's house. We couldn't be in front of his house because he lives in a gated community. So we had to stand outside the gates of the gated community on the public street to hold our protest, or Cindy had to hold her protest that I showed up at. And you know, you can't, they are so insulated. The super rich in this country are so insulated, they're never even going to notice us. You know, what we need to be doing is mobilizing a political movement that will change the structure of our tax and trade laws so that these very, very, very insanely, obscenely rich folks, you know, $80 billion and whatnot, that their wealth is somewhat diminished, and the rest of us, the middle class of America, can have back their middle class. I don't see that as going to their houses. I don't think they're going to care. And I see that as going to Congress. But I understand your sentiment, Liz, and I don't disagree with your goal. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. It is 10 minutes before the hour, and Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Tom. I think just a few minutes ago you had people in our age range calling in, a lot of them, because one of the things that I have thought seriously about when you started talking about they no longer talk about the middle class is now that the range in the top 10% or even the top 1%, the range between the very top and the very bottom is huge.
Yes.
Just huge. And if the people who, if they've destroyed the middle class or pretty much done away with the middle class, now those people are becoming, let's say, the middle class. What makes them think for one minute, the people who are still making good, that the guys at the very top aren't coming after them too?
Yeah. Yeah.
But they don't want to turn us into India. I don't know if you ever watch Vice. I think it's on, I don't know if it's on HBO or Showtime. They showed a show from India. And India has a class of people that are upper class. But the number of people who are washing in a river, the Ganges River, which is full of raw sewage,
right,
the people that are living on the banks of the Ganges River because they have no place else to live, and they're drinking, I mean, that's America could very easily be turned into that, and then you'll have these enclaves of very rich people with their military police protecting them. And I sound like a stupid, you know.
That's what we already have. I mean, they have private security in these gated communities.
And, yeah, well, yes, that's what killed George Zimmerman, right? Private security. Or not. That's
Trayvon Martin.
Zimmerman was and
yeah.
killed Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, yeah. Well, arguably. I mean, that was more of a volunteer thing. But I think that was a gated community, too, was it not? Or something
yes,
close
was.
To it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so how do we turn America into Alberta and wake people up?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I look at what happened in Alberta as a really good sign, but how do we achieve something like that in America, which is much larger than Alberta?
We do what we're doing right now. We talk about these issues. Carol, we bring them forward. You know, I share it with you. You share it with four or five other people. We just, you know, as Bernie says, we've got to build a movement. Nothing happens in America. Nothing happens anywhere in the world without a movement. And movements are person to person. I mean, yeah, you get these phony movements like the Tea Party that was basically wholly funded and paid for by, you know, a couple of fat cats, the Scaife Foundation and the Koch brothers and whatnot. It didn't last very long, at least as a grassroots movement, because it was AstroTurf. But a real movement, I mean, you know, a real movement can last for a long, long time. Arguably, the suffrage movement is still going on in the women's movement. Arguably, the early union movement is still going on in the workers' rights and the demand for 15 movement.
And if you look back at the peace movement, which I think we were all involved in and really got us fired up,
yeah.
We let the powers that be turn that into sex, drugs, rock and roll.
Right.
Instead of what it really was. So this time we have to stay in and on keeping this movement alive.
I agree. Although there's nothing wrong with sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Oh,
so, Carol, I got to move along. Thank you very much for the call. I understand exactly what you're saying, though. Charles in Parkville, Maryland. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great.
Today. Hey, Tom, I just wanted to get your thoughts. Earlier today, I was listening to Glenn Beck, and he was pretty much saying tidbits of that commencement speech that Michelle gave, and he would come back and say, Miss Obama, you know, whites and Native Americans and Hispanics have never experienced these things that you're addressing in this commencement speech, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Wait a minute. Okay, let's take Glenn Beck out of the equation, if that's all right with
okay.
you, because I didn't see it, I didn't hear it, and I can't attest to the accuracy of it. But what I can say is that any white person who asserts that white people in this country, at any point in our history, have suffered as much as people of color, is nuts. I don't know how else to say it, Charles. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here, Tom.
Yeah.
I'm here. It was mind-boggling when
yeah.
he was,
this is the variation on Bill O'Reilly's denial of white privilege. Come on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Okay.
Well, I love your show, Tom, and keep up the good fight, guys.
Thank you, Charles. Thanks a lot for the call. Sharon in Upper Lake, California. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just wanting to let you know and put a shout out to the country that I have two nephews, actually three. They applied for food stamps, and the nephew that is a disability, he didn't have to pay his food stamps now, but California is now going after you to pay it back when you get a job because I make the $50 payment a month.
Whoa. So food stamps are now a loan?
I guess it's a loan because as soon as you get a job, you have to pay it back.
That's astonishing.
And I've heard, you know, I listen to you every day, and I've never heard anybody say that. You know,
I did
once
not.
You get a job, you have to pay it back.
I did not know that. I know that, you
yeah,
know, there's
so,
that. There's something like that that has to do with Medicaid and elderly people. I've told the story here a number of times. No need to recount it of, you know, when my mom died and, you know, how basically you have to bankrupt the family before you can get Medicaid to pay for things like nursing homes.
Right. It's around that same line. But I
yeah.
just wanted to let you know, and this is one of the poorest counties in California, Lake County. And I was just shocked that, and if you don't pay it, you know, the interest just keeps rolling.
Yeah, Yeah.
So he's 23 years old. I mean, let's give him some kind of a hope for a credit of, you know.
Right. You know, the Republicans love to say, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. How about we help some folks get some bootstraps? Sharon, thanks a lot for the call. And thank you all for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to participate. You have to show up. So check out, you know, all these great sites, all these great organizations out there that are doing good stuff that you can participate with. PDAmerica.org, MoveToAmend.org, MPVUSA.org, BernieSanders.com. Check it out. We'll see you tomorrow. Ted, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.